Okay, this is side two of session 11, July 31st, 2006. So continuing with the quote, the flower people, likewise, will soon take over the bureaucratic function of state and army in order to propagate peace in Peter Pan. So I was saying that the McLuhan's predicting that the boomer TV boomer generation will be rearview mirror, and they will try to propagate an image of peace and idealistic, I don't know what you call Peter Pan, but idealistic utopian fantasies, while all around them, incredible violence will be unleashed and will undermine any of these bureaucratic attempts. And the flower people, the TV generation, being literate industrialized products, that's their legacy. They will, they were trained that way, and the content is part of their brains, and they will be bureaucrats. And
you know, it's interesting is when I was about, I think I was probably about 7 years old when they retrieved Peter Pan. I don't know if they were turning it into theater for the first time or if they were retrieving it as a form of theater. And it was going around the towns, and they were, you know, it was my folks took me to see, and my friends to see Peter Pan. From
where were you living then?
In the San Fernando Valley.
Okay.
And this would have been about 1966 or 7, I think. And so I was being indoctrinated into that Peter Pan idea. And I remember, you know, I remember feeling the violence underneath. Like, it felt like the story didn't quite jive with me, because as a child I'm trying to think in terms of this Peter Pan world, but another part of me is realizing that underlying all that is all this violence, and it didn't make sense.
You mean the violence in the media or violence of Captain Hook?
I think the violence in the media.
Yeah, that
the
where you really were living.
Yeah, where I was really living, yeah.
Yeah. And you had, you're talking about the subconscious impressions of that. And you said, in other words, you said, well, this is real old-fashioned.
Yeah, I couldn't buy into the fantasy of it. I couldn't enjoy it. It didn't make sense in the context
of... Yeah, it seemed childish to a seven-year-old.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And it reminded me of something, I don't know what it was going to be, but it'll come back, because I was going to say that the idea of propagating peace in Peter Pan in bureaucratic functioning is dealing with content like tidying up nature. So propagating peace in Peter Pan is like tidying up this fantasy of nature, a product of an image from an earlier media phase, say 150 years before. That is why I juxtapose these two quotes together. Now, to show the real media violence and the real effects coming in, we have the next quote, which is from Take Today also, page 25 and 26. I just want to reread the cliche archetype. So we're leaving this quote, the flower people, likewise. Now see, I put the likewise after the statement, we are polluting earth as fast as we are tidying up nature. And that's from a different book from the flower people quote, but it follows. The flower people, likewise, as if I was writing it right after the polluting earth statement. The flower people, likewise, will soon take over the bureaucratic function of state and army in order to propagate peace in Peter Pan. That's what they hope to do. I mean, nothing like that happened. I mean, people got jobs, but they had to deal with Quaaludes in the early 70s, and then they had to deal with cocaine addiction and yuppieism and all the chaos, divorce, collapse, sexual revolution, disco. Just think of all that happened in the 70s. It was pretty hard to stay focused on propagating peace in Peter Pan.
Yeah.
I mean, actually, by the middle 70s, people who were doing that were considered throwbacks to old hippie thinking, right?
Mm-hmm.
So let's read the next quote from Take Today, which is going to get into more of the global theater reality.
Right, because this is 1972, so it came after
Cliché d'Archetype.
The previous quote. Half the world today is engaged in keeping the other half, quote, under surveillance. This, in fact, is the hang-up of the age of, quote, software and information. In the preceding, quote, hardware age, the, quote, haves of the world had kept the, quote, have-nots under, quote, surveillance. This old beat for flatfoots has now been relegated to the world of popular entertainment. And this next part is italicized. The police state is now a work of art. a bureaucratic ballet of undulating sirens. And then he finishes, that is a way of saying that the espionage activities of our multitudinous manhunters and, quote, crediting agencies are not only archaic but redundant and irrelevant.
Yeah, now that's quite a quote.
Yeah.
So in the Information Society, he says in Cliché d'Archétype, espionage is our daily activity, and everybody's engaged in espionage. It's an information environment. I mean, people are researching focus groups. They didn't call it back then, but the pollster guys, the just general surveilling of people constantly, or even engaging in talk radio. People are monitoring how people are saying things and reacting to events. They're monitoring to get a general profile of the audience and then market something for that.
Yeah. And what was going on with, was Hoover going on at that time? Or?
No, well, Hoover, he died in 72. He was kind of, he was active through the 60s, very important, but he actually was sidelined, but that's Bob knowledge. He was sort of kept out of the loop slightly late 60s, early 70s. But, you know, in the public eye, he was still the king of surveillance, but yeah, it's the Hoover era. But the thing is, McClellan's expanding our idea of surveillance. He says half the world today is engaged in keeping the other half under surveillance. Now, that means we got 3 billion people surveilling the other 3 billion. But that's if you use traditional Hoover-like surveillance. But he means any information interaction. And the it's like news reporters going out and looking at events. That's surveillance. So he's saying that software activity is the biggest environment, so half the world's engaged in keeping the other half under surveillance in all kinds of media environmental forms, not just polls and focus groups. It's just the everybody's listening.
It's sort of an unconscious, unwitting activity.
Yes, yeah. That's why he's going to lead to the end. The old idea of
there's
espionage.
There's no intelligence agency behind all of this, which is sort of orchestrating.
No, the intelligence agencies are doing their surveillance in their roles, but they're also interacting and making sure the newspapers are saying certain stories. Everybody's incestuously engaged in forming iconic images of what the news is for that day. But people are listening to TV and radio, and they're watching the what's happened to John Lennon and Yoko, and they're surveilling other activities, because this is what the phrase means. Half the world today is engaged in keeping the other half under surveillance. Everybody, and that half is anybody anywhere on the planet looking at other parts of the mediascape, which is discarnate. So it's not just on the planet. Everybody's engaged in processing information is basically what's being said here.
Would
right?
it be fair to say that we've turned our eye inward on ourselves? We're surveilling ourselves?
No, we're surveilling our extensions of ourselves. That includes the new environments that have gone inside us, what I would call the TV body and later the chip body. But you're looking out and processing information, and you're listening. The point is just think of when cars came in. When people were driving cars, they had to surveil the landscape to see how people were driving. That's different from walking. And McLuhan said that tennis, which came in the 20s and 30s, tennis became a figure in a popular sport because the activity of driving, which people were just starting to get into in the 20s and 30s, they were starting to use the periphery of their eyeball more than they were in the 19th century industrial society. So the using the edge of the eye is mimed by the sport of tennis, where you go back and forth watching the images on the edge of your eyeball. You get it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So he has half the world today is engaged in keeping the other half, quote, under surveillance. He's not just limiting it to the Hoover definition. That's why it's in quotes, right?
Yeah.
Then he's going to explain this. This, in fact, is the hang-up of the age of software, and software is in quote. Now, it's in quotes because he's talking about content information. When you're talking about media environments themselves, as software opposed to hardware industrial environments, that's the larger form of TV and radio. But the content becomes software inside the global village. So originally software is looking at the form of media, electric media versus old mechanical hardware media. But once they all start merging in the satellite tactility, then software, the form thing, becomes the content. And that becomes a hang-up because you're just looking at the content, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's why he puts software in quotes, and then after that says, and information, and information is not quotes, because information is his term for the global tactility. back to form again. So he's actually saying this, in fact, is the hang-up of the age of content and information or form. You follow that?
Yeah, I have a hard time with the form. Tactility is
tactility is the interplay of your senses. We've externalized that in the global theater. We have huge media environments interplaying, interacting, and merging, interpenetrating, because we're all inside the electronic discarnate state.
Right, and he's calling that the form.
Yes, when you're not looking at the content, you're looking at the form. What he means by looking at the form is looking at what one media stylistic for material makeup, how that affects other media. So what is television, which is electric, affect the old printed book? That's one form's effect on another form. Not what the TV content is saying, not what the book content is saying. What is the effect of radio and TV on book culture?
Right.
And the effect of that was radical modernism in England.
Yeah.
In France. That was Joyce, Lewis, Eliot, and Pound. They create new forms of literature.
Yeah.
Responding to the radio movie effect.
Yeah. Well, it's easier to conceptualize form when you're comparing media forms one to the other, but to call tactility form.
Yes. Well, we have to. What does tactility mean? It means the. It's not a sense.
It's the interplay of the forms.
Yes.
But we're calling it form. Would we call it formal causality?
It's a process. In the body, tactility organizes the sensory interplay into coherent consciousness. That's how McLuhan uses the word tactile. Now, taking that, just like he says radio is sort of like the ear, right? So we take the interplay that tactility does in our brains, and we see that it's approximated by the interplay. Once you have the global theater and instant access to media rapidly, I mean, once you had the video cam and the satellite in the late 60s, that really speeded up the discuss with Vietnam, because footage of the soldiers was coming in faster.
Yeah. But tactility itself...
It's not a machine. It's the interplay.
Can we equate it with consciousness? Can we say tactility is consciousness?
Yes, but you have to clarify what people think they mean by consciousness. You have to relate it to that. People, most cultures think consciousness, if they use the term, what they mean by consciousness is their particular cultural bias. Most people think consciousness in the West is the eye and the ear.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Awareness of seeing and hearing.
Yeah, because they're clothing consciousness with identity.
Right, and they don't think of themselves as their other senses.
Personal and cultural identities.
Yeah, that's what they think is consciousness. So it's not good, not really a good word to use. So you bring in a new word to point out what you would probably mean by consciousness, but it's too much of a loaded word.
Yeah.
So tactility is, if you...
But consciousness, we could say consciousness becomes the form.
Well, that's why I say... The interplay of the senses is organized by a nonsense, and that organizer creates coherent consciousness. I don't say consciousness, I say coherent consciousness, a product of the interplay of the different senses.
Okay.
So if you take your daily life, driving a car, listening to the radio in the car, watching TV, eating, drinking, and... daily city activities, all that media interaction is inside the satellite environment and being changed. And the satellite environment turns all the media environments into one content. So we begin to have the rule of content, or what I call the word makes the market. That's what McLuhan called it.
What's that one content?
One content.
What does that mean?
It means that there's no difference between the different media environments, because they're all responding to what's coming over the news wires.
Mm.
To keep it simple, corporations are responding to their own news networks. But every environment, with the instant access of jet travel and telephones and satellite and computer hookups, everybody has to act and react quicker.
So that does give the president a lot of responsibility. If the word makes the market and the word comes out of the president's mouth, and the president runs around saying, "I am the decision maker,"
yeah,
then he does carry a lot of power.
Yeah, he has the only power, and that is why the National Security Act in 1947 came in because they were starting to see the effects of this electric implosion, and they said the president, since he has so much responsibility, has a right to lie to the people. And his agents have the right. The intelligence information agents, yeah. The people keeping half the world under surveillance bureaucratically, oh, the old flatfoots, as we have in the quote.
Yeah. And that worked for a while, but it's not working in the Bush administration now because it's becoming apparent we're being lied to. And
it never worked in any information, in any administration since 1947. Eisenhower got caught with the U-2 scandal, and there were other scandals in his administration. You cannot keep the bureaucratic image up with this tactile effect as you get into the satellite environment. Kennedy got assassinated. Nixon got Watergated. Johnson resigned before Nixon. Carter got, nailed in 1980 with the Iraq thing, or the Iran crisis. Yeah. Every president gets nailed. No, that's why nobody wants the job.
Yeah.
It's inhuman. You have to be a... Remember what McClellan's definition is? I have it later in the book. I wonder if I could quickly find it. The automated surrogate... What is it? The automated presidential surrogate is a superlative nobody. That's the definition of the president. The automated presidential surrogate, automated, robotic, responding to the computer environment, is a superlative nobody. Because he has to be an image of integrity within the culture of America. He can't be a dope smoker or a draft dodger. But that was back in the 70s and 80s. Yeah. There's so much chaos going on, there's not even a White House anymore by the 90s, and so it becomes a different situation, a different image required. Bush is responding to the post-tactile environment, the post-information environment, totally Paleolithic. But look at every presidency has a scandal, every presidency fails, and yet the myth of the United States must keep going on so everybody remembers the supposed services of that presidential administration.
Yeah.
Look at the outrage when Reagan died.
Yeah.
The people couldn't take the week-long, almost Egyptian, pharaonic funeral. All the old radicals and whatever, people hated Reagan. They had heart attacks almost because they said, what about all the terrible things? He ruined this country in the 80s. He did this, he did that. Well,
yesterday I heard a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist talking about America's image around the world. And he felt that in the past, what we had to offer the world was this sense of American ingenuity. And he doesn't feel that the present administration is delivering that message anymore. So the world is becoming cynical about America, and the world didn't used to feel cynical about America. And because the world looks to America for, hope, I guess, he feels this administration is not doing things well.
Yeah, now that kind of commentary is so naive and silly. The thing is, of course, if I was on there, they wouldn't understand what I'm saying. But we need to take time off, forget about Pulitzer Prize, and look at what I'm talking about and study it so that you can understand what I'm saying. For example, in medieval times, the king, and Lewis spelled this out, Wyndham Lewis, the king was the enemy of the people. Because he said, in return for me protecting you, I will tax you and you will support me. And I'm not part of you. I am your, it's like a mafia godfather, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the king was the enemy. And Lewis used to use the put on of himself being an enemy. He had a journal called The Enemy. He was like the king of the art world. And so he had an enemy relationship to the daily cultural flip-floppers, okay? Now, America is the unilateral image iconic power for the global theater. It is therefore king of the planet ever since 1990-91. Therefore, it has an antagonistic enemy role because we're back at least Mesopotamian and medieval society. All these ancient societies resonate with what the conditions are that we are now. We're not a democracy. That's 19th century literacy. We have democratic functions within it that are called traditionally those institutions. We can call an election every 4 years, but it's a puny operation compared to all the other times and places that we have to have today in terms of the tactile global Finnegan's Wake we're inside of. So America, as king of the planet, must have an enemy relationship with the whole planet. You see what I'm saying? In the image world. And Bush is acting that out perfectly. Now, that is just the image of the United States as an geographical entity and a cultural history in relation to all the other cultures that everybody's involved in their own cultures, surveilling the Peruvian broadcasting networks, the Brazilian, the China, everybody's inside their own little cultural holograms. They're all interacting.
You know,
most people, it doesn't matter what the image of America is for the majority of people's experience of living under and engaged in surveillance. The image of America is only for the old newspaper industrial environments and banking situations, all right?
Yeah.
It's only one medium. So the...
But those are the medium that control power, the movement of... You can move hardware.
No, they control the alphabet and the fact that you're Scott and I'm not.
Right, and because of that, they can move hardware. They can set up and dismantle media environments.
Well, actually, money is tactility today, and they don't move it. They create the paychecks, the digital paychecks, for a sense of fluidity so other environments can go on and barter among themselves.
Yeah.
But here's the point. There was another point I want to make about the today, America, and Rush Limbaugh makes this point, just citing him as a syndrome. He says, all these people hate America, but they're damn trying hard to get in here.
Yeah.
You get all these immigrants coming over the Mexican border, right? They hate America,
border?
The image of America. The but they still got to come.
The borders are open. There is, I believe, a conscious, willful activity among, if you want to, whatever you want to call government these days, to allow North America to become a union.
Right. Now that's just from the perspective of bureaucratic institutions, like you said, whatever you call government. There is chaos, decentralized chaos going on. There is immigrants getting over with no problem, but there's also militaristic survivalists, whatever they are, militiamen, minutemen down there killing people, right, when they get a chance to find them.
Yeah.
And so none of these all of these attempts to either open the borders or to close them are puny operations because the flood of goods and people can't be stopped, and drugs and everything else.
They're building a superhighway from Mexico to Canada. It'll run through the United States so they can import cheap goods from China into Mexico and then run them up through all the way up the
continent. Right. And that is an old industrial environment, one of the old media, trucks and transport, food for the chemical body or whatever, while there is no Mexico and Brazil or North America in the chemical, or in the TV body, in the chip body, in the TV, in McLuhan's terms, in the discounted landscape. I'm in China every day. You're in China every day. I'm also in every other country, keeping everything under surveillance. So you have to perceive all the environments that are interacting in this tactile way in relation to any puny topic you bring up.
Yeah.
And that's like shows like, any TV shows, they're puny. They operate on little nouns, little verbs, little people, you know, and they offer a little tiny fragment of a scenario, and they emphasize that for a couple minutes, and they go to another one. I mean, it's done on Art Bell, George Lurie. They focus on some little trivial topic in English,
yeah.
And they think it has a reality. It has a reality for people, back to this quote, experiencing the discounted state and keeping everything under surveillance. It's like you're in the middle of a desert, and you have to stay out there and keep aware of what's going on. So people turn on the media to keep aware of what's going on in the desert. Right?
Mm.
So it says here, half the world today is engaged in keeping the other half, quote, under surveillance. This, in fact, is the hang-up of the age of software, in quotes, and information. In the preceding hardware age, and hardware is in quotes, the haves of the world, now that's consumer chemical body stuff, the haves of the world had kept the have-nots under surveillance. You don't have haves and have-nots when you have a TV body. You still have your marginal chemical body, which, and McLuhan didn't use these terms, but I'm using my terms to explain this quote. The haves and the have-nots for the chemical body are under surveillance, but once you get into the age of software, people have TV and discounted bodies, and they're consuming information, and it's relatively free. It was until pay TV in the 70s and 80s. In the 50s, 40s, 50s, 60s, people had access to all kinds of information, and there was no division between haves and have-nots in terms of software, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how do you don't control the consumables of the industrial age, what we call the haves and have-nots. it's not have and have not in the software age. It's just half the world keeping the other half under surveillance. And it's like Shem and Sean and Finnegan's Wake. They're interchangeable. There's actually nobody keeping anybody under surveillance. Just everybody's imploded processing the information environment. But if you take the alphabet in that you're Scott and I'm Bob, then Scott is surveilling me and I'm surveilling you. But that's just in alphabetic visual space terms. We actually are in the same space.
Yeah.
So they're pointing that out. So then you look at what is the role of the traditional surveillance institutions, which he calls flatfoot. So he says, this old beat of surveillance, industrial hardware, of the haves over the have-nots, you know, the capitalists over the communists, so to speak, and vice versa. This old beat for flatfoots has now been relegated to the world of popular entertainment, to the world of, quote, software, of entertainment content. And that's Mission Impossible, I Spy, the James Bond movies, that all started 40 years ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it was because it was obsolete, so therefore it could be made into popular entertainment. Now, one subtlety, though, is James Bond, the spy world is obsolete. It's made into entertainment, but the entertainment is responding to new media pressures. So James Bond fighting some criminal is the beginning of the effect of the satellite, where one person can hijack whole media environments. All right?
Mm-hmm.
Like Goldfinger. It's an old form. Let me say, an old story adapted to the present. So McLuhan would comment on the James Bond world and say, very relevant because it's showing it's a CIA world. It's a world where the word makes the market. You see?
Mm-hmm.
So it's always a rearview mirror as well as the present mixed in popular blockbusters, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Things that become legendary, mythical, or stars.
Right.
So the police state, and then he has in italics, the police state is now a work of art. Okay, everybody's worried about George Bush bringing in 1984. Well, they worried about that under Reagan 20 years ago. The point is that you couldn't have the Orwellian world. It could only be a work of art, a bureaucratic ballet of undulating sirens.
Huh.
Now, the bureaucratic ballet is the media ecology of everybody keeping under surveillance every other institution, FBI spying on the CIA, spying on the Treasury, spying on the State Department, spying on Hollywood. All these media imploded inside the tactile global theater environment. So he takes an image from the Homer story, the Odyssey, about Ulysses encountering the sirens, right? The singing sirens. He had to put wax in the ears of his fellow sailors, and he strapped himself to the mast so he could hear the sirens but not be killed by them, right?
By their seduction, basically.
Yeah. And so every day, all kinds of corporations have press conferences, government institutions have press conferences, every media institution has press conferences. They're always putting out press releases for other corporations or for the media and the public in general. Think of all that activity, which is going on right now, is a bureaucratic ballet of undulating sirens to pretend that there is something being organized. That's the police state as a work of art. Also, I once mentioned this to Eric McLuhan. I said, what do you mean, what do you think they mean when they say the police state is now a work of art? He said, well, that's like a cop at a traffic lights. You know, the police state now is policemen directing all the traffic. Work of art. Anyway, that was his response. It gives you another level of the pun level on the word police state.
Uh-huh.
So the police state is now a work of art. Now, there's the word art, small a, compare that to the capital A art that we're polluting. I'm juxtaposing quotes here. Is a work of art, a bureaucratic ballet of undulating sirens. Basically, that's press releases. Then other institutions reacting to the press releases. So then McLuhan says, that is a way of saying, the police state is now a work of art, that is a way of saying that the espionage activities of our multitudinous manhunters and crediting agencies are not only archaic, but redundant and irrelevant. In other words, they're engaged in the old form of surveillance, and because they are irrelevant, they're a work of art. They're the rearview mirror. They don't even exist. They don't even have any power in relation to the power of everybody keeping involved, half the world engaged and surveilling the other half.
The multitudinous manhunters and crediting agencies. Now, these are people that are going after money on the streets.
Yeah, they're harassing. These are the holdovers from the industrial age that are going after what McLuhan called the poor man's credit card. He said money was the poor man's credit card. So it's a world of credit, but the average citizen locked inside their industrial structure still have to use cash. And they employ a lot of citizens, or a lot of citizens are employed in monitoring those that do not use cash fairly. Either they're organized crime, or they're not paying their taxes, or they're not paying their bills. So you have a lot of surveillance by the old IRS and FBI institutions looking after taxes and crime. They're the multitudinous manhunters and crediting. He has crediting in quotes. Crediting agencies are not only archaic, because they're trying to monitor old visual space, whereas real wealth is created by the daily surveillance of everybody, keeping the other half under surveillance, which is the information environment. That is the wealth of the society. That is the real cash flow. If they turned off the electric environment, we'd have to go back to the 20s when cash was the ground.
Well, why is the United States wealthier than other countries, consumes more of the world's energy resources and so on?
That's for old-fashioned university agencies and think tanks to do crediting, updating of the crediting agencies, comparing non-existing state and national statistics versus other national statistics. That's the old bureaucratic work of art. The Noam Chomsky's, you know, the guy's inventorying statistics and comparing the United States. The United States doesn't have a cent. That's because there is no United States. There is media environments on the geographical location known as North America, but they're interacting and imploding within media environments all over the world. So why was Enron, which is just a recent, you know, blatant example, unable to have any money? Because there's no money on that level of virtual economy exchange of tax derivatives and information patterns. That's all they do. Their wealth is based on information patterns, but you have to translate back into the old media environments. No media environments go away. We still have private alphabetic identities and accounting books. We were talking about this last week. And so what does it mean to say that the United States is the wealthiest country? It has the most developed media environments, but they're not measurable by money. They're just measurable by the ability of large numbers of people to engage in them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you just need a certain... I mean, the real estate bubble is built on people giving away houses to people, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's so much competition in the mortgage industry over the last 10 years that they were making all kinds of, in old terms of accounting, ridiculous offers. I mean, people were getting mortgages at really good rates, and they were unrealistic in old terms. But the point is you had to keep people living in these environments and keep the environments in motion. So we live in a free-for-all of access to all kinds of things. But every now and then, visual space comes through, and Greenspan will have to say, right, we got to raise the interest rates. And then everybody is caught in the crossfire, and people become homeless.
Mm-hmm.
So the chemical body is in and out of these environments. And there's no personal justice within them. If you're caught in the crossfire, too bad. Because the environments are communicating among themselves, and visual space needs to reassert itself every now and then, and so a lot of people get wiped out when that happens.
Well, there seems to be a grassroots political movement among the Latinos. I think it's beginning in Mexico and probably spilling over into the United States to some degree, where they're looking for, they want to get their political representatives into office, not through the, not because they've been bought and sold, but because they've been voted for by people at the grassroots level who care about their local community and their local lives.
So your point is?
That there's this I don't know. I think it all ties back to some ecology of growth or first nature or something.
Okay, don't apply McLuhan since we're doing the right side, right hand pages of my book. We're in the McLuhan thread here. What's the latest environment? What is the ground? what technologies are happening, and what are these these responses or figures. You got Bolivia. You got not just Enron. You got global bankruptcy everywhere in a lot of countries. And so people, I call this the Paleolithic phase. People are forced to start interacting with each other and regrowing their countries. And so Bolivia has a guy who's just coming in, and he's representing community people because these people live locally. They don't have jet planes to fly around. They are suffering due to the jet plane society and the computer digitalized society because their old chemical body environments have been dumped as ghettos. And so eventually humans will gather together. So you have a lot of what I call post-information society human chemical body gatherings going on. Now, whether they'll be able to interface with the TV body environments and the chip body environments is the big question. I mean, Bush, in a sense, represents this post-information society because he's going around interacting with media environments in the world unilaterally, imposing a pattern on them, and disregarding his information PR image. So when the Pulitzer Prize guy says America's image has gone down, they don't look at the ground and why Bush is responding. Bush is the American version of the Bolivian guy. His name's Evo, E-V-O, I think. So you got these phenomena going on all over the place. Look, Argentina collapsed a few years ago, and the people had to start organizing stuff. But most of these organizations on grassroots levels are semi-futile because they've got to interact with their own chip bodies and TV bodies as environments that have possessed them, whether they know it or not. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like that guy was telling you...
Because there's no regulation of the chip bodies and the TV bodies in the sense of having media ecology.
Right. They regulate within themselves, reacting and competing. And for example, the chip body wiped out Peter Jennings, Dan Rather, and Tom Brokaw. I just was reading an article on Dan Rather, you know, he left the CBS a month ago in a huff. They wouldn't keep him in the old status. He wouldn't leave without the old status, so he's marginalized into some high-definition TV company. But, I mean, he's obsolete.
Yeah.
There was another point I was saying.
The types that they're being replaced with are more people that come from entertainment shows,
right.
Like the View or the whatever the...
yeah, Katie Kirk and Madeline Ferreira from The View, whatever... Melanie Verrera, or whatever her name is. Yeah, it's women. You know, you need women to, they're pleasant faces as everything's getting more and more in your face. You'd rather have a blonde bombshell in your face than old crusty Dan Rather, right?
Yeah.
And in other words, it's rampant fatty communication. And you got to have friendly waivers.
Right.
Friendly hand waving. I started to say some individual. I forget what I was going to say.
So the idea of journalistic integrity in the sense of the old...
That's under information society. That's, in other words, what we're this quote we're reading from McLuhan is right on for its time 30 years ago, but it's a little obsolete now.
Yeah.
At best, it's retrieved in less developed countries.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to reread it clearly, and then we'll move on to the next one.
All right.
Half the world today is engaged in keeping the other half, quote, under surveillance. This, in fact, is the hang-up of the age of, quote, software and information. Note that software and information is not in quotes, but software is. McLuhan means that. You need to understand. Think about that. The next sentence. In the preceding, quote, hardware age, the, quote, haves of the world had kept the, quote, have-nots under, quote, surveillance. And again, surveillance is in quotes. Why not just say they're surveillance? Why have it in quotes? Because it's being compared to the new environment, which is a different kind of surveillance. It's a surveillance of watching, just watching the news. This old beat for flatfoots, the old industrial hardware age, has now been relegated to the world of popular entertainment. The police state is now a work of art, a bureaucratic ballet of undulating sirens. And that whole sentence is in italics. That is a way of saying that the espionage activities of our multitudinous manhunters and crediting agencies are not only archaic, but redundant and irrelevant, because they are going after the chemical body, and that's not the whole story. So McLuhan is saying... That is a way of saying that the espionage activities of our multitudinous manhunters and credit agencies on the TV body are not only archaic, but redundant and irrelevant when you consider the TV body and the chip body landscapes. Follow me?
Yeah.
So then the next quote is a tetrad on the instant replay, which is the environment that's coming in around the time I'm presenting these quotes, 1970. Late 60s, early 70s, when we start to have the instant replay. So I'm placing this in the sequence of quotes we've done, three quotes, which are about the period 69 to 72, right?
Mm-hmm.
So for our audience, listeners at home, could you read the tetrad?
Yeah.
This is from a book called The Global Village, which was put out after McLuhan died by a book that was done in the 70s with a guy named Bruce Powers, apparently a former CIA agent, who was a professor at the University of Buffalo or in that region in upstate New York. He put out a book under Oxford University Press in 1989 called The Global Village, which was largely built on stuff he did with McLuhan in the 70s. And so this is from page 176.
Tetrad on the instant replay, four parts, A, B, C, and D. Part A, instant replay of experience equals the cliché. And then there's a colon, and it says amplifies cognitive awareness.
A semicolon.
Semicolon.
So this is the first part of the tetrad. What does the instant replay amplify? Amplifies cognitive awareness. And instant replay of experience equals the cliché. What is it obsolete? That's the B phase.
Mm-hmm. But,
let's read it.
Okay. The B phase wipes out the merely representational and chronological.
The C phase is that's the letter C, refers to what is retrieved.
Right. And retrieves, quote, meaning. And that's attributed to I.A. Richards.
Yes, he wrote the famous book, The Meaning of Meaning, about 1923. That's where the phrase phatic communion came. It was in an appendix essay by Malinowski, the anthropologist. He coined the phrase phatic communion, and this had a big influence on James Joyce and Marcel Duchamp, and the book was called The Meaning of Meaning.
Okay.
And the D level of this tetrad is what does instant replay flip into when overused as an environment?
It flips from individual experience to pattern recognition. The nature of the archetype.
Right. So we've gone from A is the cliche, and it flips into archetype. Right?
Yeah.
And the quote just below that, after that, the bottom of page 17 of my book, is from the book From Cliche to Archetype that lays out the cliche archetype process. And this is from page 15. It says, that group of archetypalists who consider the linguistic form to be a recurring pattern of literary experience describe what is antithetic to the cliché as probe.
That's going to need some major elucidation.
Yeah, I just want to show how the words cliché and archetype are used in the upcoming quotes, which we'll go into in detail, but I'll give you a few examples. The next quote from page 150 of From Cliché to Archetype is, quote, a cliché is an act of consciousness, colon, total consciousness is the sum of all the cliches of all the media or technologies we probe with. Further down, there's a quote, page 205 of the book From Cliché to Archetype. The happening, talking about the 60s happenings, the happening exploits not only the clash of one cliché against another, but also the much more effective interface of a cliché from one medium with clichés from other media. Later, here's another use of the word archetype. From Cliché to Archetype, the book, page 14, McLuhan says, the outer trip has been specialist and Western. The inner trip has been ecological. That's a pun, eco, but it's echo, E-C-H-O. The inner trip has been ecological and oriental. That's, to me, what you meant when you said we go inner. That's ecological, the inner voices. Both kinds of trips are cliché probes. Each has its own methods and preferences of retrieval from the rag-and-bone shop of past experience. The outer trip prefers to retrieve antiquities or archetypes. The inner trip prefers the probing cliché world of the module. So I'm reading these just to show you how McLuhan plays with the words archetype and cliché. Another one at the bottom of page 21 of my book is a quote from Cliché to Archetype, which is actually page 21 also from that book. And McLuhan writes, the archetype is a retrieved awareness or consciousness. It is consequently a retrieved cliché, an old cliché retrieved by a new cliché. Since a cliché is a unit extension of man, an archetype is a quoted extension, me medium, technology, or environment. So, yeah, we've got a lot of explaining to go on there, right?
Yeah.
So let's go back to the tetrad of instant replay. We know he's dealing with the relationship between cliche and archetype. Now, this is another book. It's not the cliche archetype book. It's the book with powers called The Global Village. And it said, enhances the cliche and flips into the archetype, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he defines archetype as group pattern recognition. He defines cliche as the replay of experience.
Replay of experience.
Yes, the if we have an experience, then I speak. Then speech is a cliche because it's a form of replaying the experience. I talk about what I saw or experienced, right?
Yeah.
And that amplifies cognitive awareness. Now, in the saddle, the global theater of
cognitive awareness is being distinct from the sphere of the intellect.
Yes.
And slightly different from the sphere of direct perception.
I think it'd be more direct perception. It's basically just being aware of it.
Direct perception is just sensation. Cognition implies recognition.
Right. Yeah, we could say this is the interval between percept and concept.
Okay.
He uses recognition. So he should have said amplifies cognitive awareness, but I'll grant you that he means by cognitive recognizing in this context here. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because simple cognitive awareness would be percept. And then the explanation of the talking about the percept would be concept, and that would be cliche in this sense here.
Mm.